the award-winning Factbollard show this week, Quality of Life versus Saving. Hey, I'm Christia van Yedden. With me as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It is good. I am 2 sleeps away from holiday. In fact, when you're listening to this podcast, I will be holiday.
Oh, that's so nice. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, so all you peeps out there listening, happy non-holidays.
That also means that we're recording a double episode this week. So this week's episode and next week's episode, we're both recording on the same day. It's the day after we once again have found a new finance minister.
Yeah, another day, another finance minister.
I've realized that this is the government's plan to solve the unemployment crisis. Just give everybody a chance to be finance minister.
Oh, no. So I've actually given thought. I was chatting to the guys at BDTV about this. I want to be the tourism minister, and I don't need an office. I'm a cost cutter. I'll always be on site.
Yeah, your tourism minister with an unlimited Airbnb budget. That sounds wonderful. If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that we a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. That's who we are, by the way. Thank you to Sean Combrink for bleeping us. It's very nice for you to make us decent. So it turns out the markets don't really enjoy our finance minister bingo that we tend to play.
No, our market is what we colloquially, the technical term is
That's certainly the term I would use.
I mean, you can argue the definition, but yeah.
So the Factbollard listener love index is down 15.36%. How much can we take Steinhoff out now?
On what rule?
On the that we don't love it anymore.
I think more than half of those stocks we don't love anymore.
I just want to see what the impact would be if we took Steinhoff to zero. What would happen?
Probably not much, because it came in at such a giant price. It came in at...
I'm just making everything zero. Is that not going to work?
No, shares and index, you've done it. That'll be it. So shares and index at zero.
But it doesn't do anything.
Yeah, because Steinhoff started life at like $50. Now that it's two, it's lost 98% of its value. It's only 4%, 4.7% of the index. So if it now loses the remaining 100% of its value, but it's it's just got nothing left.
Yeah, because when I take it out, the index actually does worse.
So it's because it's weighted at the initial price. And oddly enough, I don't see the initial price here. And now it's 96 down. So now its weighting is actually only 3.5% of 4.7% within the index. So its weighting is quickly trying to do the math.
So I've got here share price at listing at 180 Rand 62.
Steinhoff? No, never got above.
Hang on.
Never
sorry.
Got above 90.
65 Rand 90.
Sorry, there's the price. 65 Rand 90.
And it's now at 2 Rand 28.
Yeah, so it's down 96%. So it's waiting because we don't rebalance. So we never. So if it had stayed in our love index, what we would have done was rebuy Steinhoff to get it back to the 4.7% weighting. But we don't. So therefore, it stays at it's a fraction. It's now, you know, if that thing doubled tomorrow, our index wouldn't even blink.
If you don't know what we're talking about, you can go search the Listener Love Index on justonelap.com. We made our own index and it's really bad.
No, it proved a brilliant point.
We shouldn't be making indices. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Hence.
But then again, the Zach One Lap Index, which is an index made by a person who makes indices, is also down almost 5%.
Yeah, today. But let's pause here a second. There's been some divs coming through, and it was August 16, and our market closed back then at around 49.5. We were at 47. So our market's down a little over 5. So he is...
So he's beating the market.
Slightly ahead of market.
All right. Well,
yeah.
He's doing well, but so well is
that's
not
the,
good.
That's the concept of relative return versus absolute return.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel good, but you are beating the market. Like really? Like, I'm poorer.
Yeah.
Don't tell me this is good.
Okay, our win of the week this week is Darren, who really wants to be a good uncle. He says, my sister lives in the UK and they have 3 little boys. I don't want to spend money on toys and Amazon gifts, and I wanted to do a tax-free savings account for them. They're very unlikely to move back to South Africa. Are there any companies or banks that do this overseas, specifically in the UK, and what methods would one go through? Any other advice on these types of matters?
So it gets complicated because his sister would need to fika them, and she can't fika with a UK address. If he could hack around that problem, the kids would have to draw the money into a South African bank account, which they couldn't do without a South African address. So short answer is no. So he's basically got two options. The UK actually has a similar type of product with a much, much larger limit. And it's an IAAS or something like that.
What? IES or IAS?
IAS, A for Apple. I think that's what it's called. So you could actually fund that for them.
How does that work though? Would he have to turn his money into pounds and then
So then he has to convert the money. So this happens in the UK on the LSE. He would have to send ZAR across and it would then become pounds, and he would then go and invest within that product. And maybe it isn't called IAS because Google looks at me all squiff when I Google it. But he would have to do that. His other alternative is to, for example, just buy the FTSE 100 tracker in South Africa, which therefore will give him return of the FTSE, but will also give him the currency hedge for sterling. Because the risk is they kids, and in 40 years' time, sterling is now whatever, and when you cash, and then, you know, so.
But if he does it in South Africa, he would do it in his own name.
He would have to do it in his own. I mean, yeah.
And then just maybe allocate that money in his will or something.
Actually, that's quite cunning. I hadn't thought of that. Allocate the money in his will. Depends how old or young he is. I can't find this tax-efficient giving LSE, but certainly there is something, and that's going to be the easier way. There will be a little more cost, so maybe he doesn't want to do it like every birthday, maybe bulk it up and once a year shift over the money for all three of them, etc., because of costs of moving the money and all of that sort of stuff. If he does it in his own name in South Africa, he's liable for the tax, which, yes, he can slice off them. But, and I don't know which is a more favorable tax regime. I don't know what his tax rate is.
It seems like the easiest thing to do would just be to fika the kids with his own address. Like have his sister fika the kids with his own address and open local accounts for them.
Well, she couldn't because she couldn't prove she lives there. So he could do it as a guardian in South Africa, but then getting the money out. Yeah. Sorry, noisy. Then he's got to get the money out, and the money needs to go into the name of. So at this point, it's no problem. Now, you can be 2 years old, you've got a tax-free account, you don't need a bank account but when you want the money out, it needs to go into a bank account of the name of the person to whom this tax-free account is authorized.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I would dig around in the UK, see what they've got.
Yeah, the only thing that concerns me about that is that currency conversion, because that's going to get expensive. Eventually.
There's ways of doing it more efficiently. There's that shift from Standard Bank, and et cetera. I mean, yes. I mean, there is that issue. There certainly is that issue.
So that's why I'm thinking it almost makes more sense to just like turn it into a huge pile of money here. And then deal with all that once or once.
The trick is that the tax-free, I mean, there's no simple way for him to do it tax-free for them. So he could just do it in a normal account and then take the hit. It will be a long-term hold. This is going to be more than 3 years. So it will be CGT rather than income tax, which is what maxes out at around 18%, depending how much you earn. Take the hit or leave it in your will. Yeah. Which is very cunning. And it depends what your ultimate size of your estate is.
It also depends when they would need the money. Because if they want to use the money to, pay for varsity or whatever, and Darren doesn't feel like dying just then, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, no. So if you leave it in the will, then you're leaving it, for whatever his life expectancy is, which is, probably 80 or 90 years or something like that. That would seem to be... And then ship it over. So, and that's the trick. I mean, it waiting on dying is not cool. So then, if you want to then just buy it and say, look, I've got this pile of cash, that'll be less than 20% because of tax liability.
Yeah.
And but see, the thing is, is that 20% is quite a hit. So, you know, how much are you paying on moving money every time you move money overseas? Let's say it's 2%, which is a crazy amount, but it's 2% of the money and not the growth, because the growth is already there. So it's 2% of the base money that you move, as opposed to 20% of the entire amount, including the growth. That 2% in the base is a more attractive number. Of course, it comes out so you get less growth over time, but I still think it's probably a more attractive number. The other side of the coin is there'll be tax implications, but if they want, for example, the money when they're 20, they're probably not in a high tax income bracket in the UK at that point.
What
if you're a student, they're not paying tax.
What if Darren asks his sister to do a crowdfunding thing in the UK? Because, you know, you get services like Adabit or whatever. What if his sister opens a crowdfunding thing for her kids in the UK? She sorts out the tax over there. Darren can just pay into that fund, because normally you can just use a credit card or something to just pay into that fund whenever he wants. Maybe that's just like an easier way to do it.
Yeah, but so credit cards on those things, they hit you for the fee, which is a percent or two. There'll still be currency conversions, et cetera, et cetera.
It would be a lot easier, though.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Darren's sister doesn't even have to do it. Darren can do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think open them LSE accounts.
All right.
Not saying that's the easy route. It's just what I'm saying.
Okay, well, you have some options, Darren. That's the point. So my friend Andri sent me this article that was in The Guardian in the UK. I don't know why we're so UK-centric today. And it's about this woman who lives in London, and she kind of brags about the fact that she spends almost 2,000 Rand per month on dog food. So now I understand that cost of living in London is very different from cost of living in South Africa, but I've converted everything into rands as opposed to pounds, just to give a sense of what we're dealing with here. So, and this kind of got me thinking, because Fred also wrote, had a health scare, and he wrote something along the line. So I thought, let's just talk about how you make this decision, because when I read this article, I was like, it terrified me, but it also seemed incredibly familiar to me, because when I was in that process of racking up all that debt, this was almost exactly my way of thinking about the world. So I'm going to include a link to the article in the show notes if you guys want to go read the whole thing. It's written in the first person. So this woman works for a vintage fashion house. So she says, saving towards a deposit, she was complaining because she had to live in ratty apartments all across London. And she says, saving towards a deposit for a property felt futile. Now, I know in London is one of the highest property prices in the world. So, I mean, this is not a ridiculous thing to say. She says, instead, I moved in the other direction and upgraded my living situation. I now live with my friend in a lovely two-bedroom flat just 2 minutes away from my office. At 16,544 Rand plus bills, it's substantially more than the 10,997 Rand I was paying, but I save on travel too. I was so fed up of commuting over an hour each way, it was making me miserable. My credit card and overdrive combined comes to about 48,660 Rand. I always start my day with an oat milk flat white, that's a coffee, which I think costs 68 Rand 12 cents. I'll often stop to buy another one in the afternoon. I tend to eat lunch and dinner out every day. I guess that sets me back about 9,700 Rand a month. I never cook at home anymore. I might spend about 400 Rand a week filling up a basket with items such as hummus, wine, and chocolate. To mitigate all of this, I spend about 1,900 Rand a month on a gym membership. So her point is, she was living within her means, and she didn't like it because it was soups hard. And now she's making these choices about where her money should be going, and it just seems like she's making really grateful choices.
Yeah, I mean, so the apartment and paying more, I mean, the saving in travel and both money and time, I can live with that. I can look at that and say, okay, look, you've made a choice here. And if it's, you know, but the point of the matter is that she's also sitting in debt, and then the story starts to unravel. I mean, sure, making choices, but you know, your choices are going to have longer term impacts.
So she adopted a dog, an elderly ex-racing greyhound that wears a scarf worth almost 900 rand because she takes it to the office and she's like, it has to wear a scarf when it goes to the office. And she spends 2,000 rand a month on dog food. Now, like, if you have a pet, you know that 2,000 rand a month on pet food is not that much. Like, depending on the kind of pet you have and the kind of person you are when it comes to pets. But so that's not really what gets me, but it's just like this kind of thinking of, you know, you only live once and you should make the most of it and whatever. So let me get to Fred's email. He says, I had a terminal illness scare recently. During that time, I really thought about finances, leaving money for loved ones and my daughter's future. If I die today, I know that my wife and daughter will be financially secure because of my life insurance policy. The same thing if I didn't die, but I can't work and earn an income anymore. So he's got dread and disability cover. What stuck in my mind is, if I die today, I haven't yet lived. No one plans to die, yet everybody does, and most sooner than expected. I'd also like to live to 130, but we probably won't. It's very important to live during your breathing time, and to do this while building a small fortune to carry you through retirement, how on earth do you balance this? So this is the conversation I want to have, is how do you balance this, like, quality of life? I want to be closer to work. I want to have a pet. I want to, you know, leave something for my daughter, but I also want to live while I'm living thing. Like, how do we get this
right? So I think there are a couple of things. And first question is, what's important? So, you know, does living include, to the woman living in London, is it eating out every night? No. I mean, I speak from experience. I've done the 5 or 6 dinners out a week. The food was nice, and I still remember some of the meals. And I still think the best chef, Jason Black, that South Africa's ever had. Sorry, his son, Chris, sorry, brother, etc. And you know, it was all lovely and everything else, but there's a balance, and that point is the balance. I mean, the suggestion is not that you live in a broom cupboard and have zero life and save like crazy. The flip is that not that you live on, you know, 500,000 rand credit card and drive a fancy car and are unable to retire at any point. There's a balance there, and that balance is what's important. Yeah, and oddly enough, I was listening to a podcast just yesterday from the Motley Fool talking about so these guys weren't the FIRE, financial independence, retire early. They were financial independence. And what they were saying, and the guy's like, you know what, I earn less than I could, but when my three daughters, his kids who are like 7, 8, and 10 years old, when they come home in the afternoon, he's at home to engage them. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they play board games. And he says, that to me is what's important. And he's made sacrifices to get to that point. Now, in his case, his sacrifices on the income side. So he's got a less fancy job, which would make him work, including transport, because he's also in the UK 18 hours a day. But he said, it's the choices. And it is a balancing act. And I do think that we run the risk of going too far to either direction. I mean, you've been too far to the spending side.
Actually, I've been too far both sides now.
I think there is a risk. The difference is that your risk of saving too much is that you retire with too much money or you retire too early. I get the point from Andries, who's saying, but hang on a second. Was it Andries?
Fred,
who's saying, but hang on a second. You know, like, when I'm 80, I can't enjoy my money. And yeah, if, you know, my mother-in-law's 80-odd, and she's not having a great time of this life at the moment. And if she had a vast amount more money, life wouldn't be any better.
So, I want to go through some of these choices that this woman makes. Because, like, as you said, there's nothing wrong with making... So, like, I'm thinking about the whole pet thing, because I am now, like, on the verge of getting a pet. And I really want one, right? And I don't... Like, I'm not crazy with my money.
Should you get a Tamagotchi?
Tamagotchi.
Yeah.
I wonder if you still get those.
I'm sure
probably
you do.
Like an iPhone app now. So, like, I and Andries, incidentally, the guy who sent me this article, has two pets, and his one just had a very expensive neck operation. But he is a very financially responsible person, and his pets are his big expense. And so, like, the heading of this article is, I spent £100 a month on food for my dog. He eats better than I do, which, when you read the article, you realize is just
not true.
But it makes it sound like this is her biggest issue. Her dog eats 2,000 rands worth of food in a month. But that's not actually her biggest issue.
No.
Her biggest issue is that she increased her cost of living from 11,000 rand a month to 17,000 rand a month like without the, and this excludes her bills in what, by making one decision.
Yeah.
And this is at the beginning of the year when I said, you should try, your challenge for the year is to try and contain your lifestyle costs where it is at the beginning of this year. This is like the opposite of what we advocate on this show. So like, how do you, if you want to live closer to work, sure.
Yeah, there's a good argument for that.
But you can make a calculation there. So you can work out exactly how much it costs you to commute to work every day in terms of like petrol and mm-hmm. like the actual transport, and also in terms of your time. So, mm-hmm. you know, your company pays you X amount of salary. Mm-hmm. You can work out what they value your time as per hour. And you can, you and your risk, which is something you and I spoke about yesterday. So what's your risk of being on the road? And yeah, can you put a monetary value on the risk of you on the road?
Being run over by a bus.
But you can add all of that together and then say, okay, at the moment I'm paying 11,000 Rand for living and I'm paying 2,000 Rand for transport. Can I find something closer to my work that would bring me, that would get me to break even point?
And that's the issue. So she states that she went for a lovely flat or whatever, etc., with her friend, a two bedroom, etc. But you're eating out every night, you're at work all day, you're walking the dog every weekend. How much time are you spending in that lovely flat? Now, I'm not suggesting you live again in a broom closet, but there's a mid ground. So as you say, so say 11,000 was what she was spending, say 2,000 was her transport cost. Push it to 14, you've squeezed it a bit. But, you know, don't just go, you know, boom and go crazy.
Yeah, because it sounds like she got to a point where she cracked. Like she was so tired of trying to make it work that she just gave up. And what really scares me about
I can relate to that. I mean, I understand that. I mean,
yeah, you don't want to struggle all the time. It is a mission. But then, you know, she pays 70 Rand a day for a coffee. Like every single day, that's not the same.
So
that's not upgrading your cost of living. That's being irresponsible with your money.
And truthfully, that's what I did. So I've got a very fancy coffee machine sitting there, which makes me really excellent coffee, and I get the most expensive beans in Joburg. And the reason is because even cost of that machine, etc., and the beans and everything comes in at like around about, now I can't remember, it's under $10 a coffee.
Whereas which you would never get.
You don't get $10 coffees in Josie.
If you do, you shouldn't drink them.
No, you do get $10 coffees. Stay away from those $10 coffees. So you know, and there's choices there. I mean, the dog, and I, you know, dog, blah blah blah. But the short answer is she can't afford it. But the bigger point is her problem is she's spending a lot of money on a dog and on a lovely place to live, and she's not living there. She's then going out and eating at night, and that to me is the easy soft spot to solve the problem. Eat at home.
Right. So
learn to cook.
This is the thing. Like if you move closer to work. So you're like 2 minutes away from your office. This is the perfect time to cook.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like she never, like it says she doesn't cook anymore, which means that she's just like kind of given up on the idea of cooking at home.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous because like that, this is...
Because eating out is expensive. It doesn't
matter. It costs her 10,000 Rand a month to eat.
Yeah.
It costs me, including detergents and stuff, cleaning materials, it costs me 2,500 Rand.
Yeah, I'm thinking for me and my wife, it's about 5.5, maybe 6.
Yeah.
That's two people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We
will... Including the cat or excluding the cat?
No, our cat's quite cheap. I mean, our cat food's a couple of hundred a month. I don't know, maybe 500 or something. Of course, the trick here is...
Does your cat have a designer scarf?
No, my cat doesn't have any scarf. And also, Lex... point out that we're all eating vegetarian. Me, not willingly, but I'm married to one and you are one, and ergo. But it you know, the moving the place, okay, so I think that you could have probably moved for a smaller price. And if you're never home, why? But I get the idea behind the moving, and I don't, you know, I can get in with that. The dog, I don't get. I mean, you want to save dogs, etc., but really save yourself first. The bigger issue is it's the eating out. And as I say, I've been down that road where I earned a outsized salary, and I say, but truthfully, I should have saved a ton lot more. But my wife and I were out like literally 5-6 times a week.
You know, in South Africa, it's so hard because we don't really have in Joburg much by way of entertainment at night. So if you are at home and you feel like going out at night, in Joburg, you basically can only go eat out. There's not much that you can do. Like, we don't have lots of live music and we don't have... You know, like we don't have parks where you can go walk at night because it's Joburg and you'll die. You know, so there's it, and this is something I heard on The Minimalists or read on The Minimalists, is the one guy was saying his life changed significantly when he started to realize that food isn't entertainment. Like, food is something to sustain you, and entertainment is entertainment. So maybe this, maybe she has the same problem, and maybe she should get a gaming console or something.
Yeah.
Like something to keep busy.
Or, you know, eat at home and go to a bar after. I mean, you know, that's still expensive, but it is cheaper.
Yeah.
Restaurant food or out food, whether it be restaurant or takeout or whatever, is expensive.
So I think the reason why this hit home for me is because I kind of made similar choices this year. So I was tired of going from rental to rental. I made a lifestyle choice, not a financial choice, a lifestyle choice to buy a place in a place that I like so that I can get a cat because I've always wanted one and now I can have one. You know, and I made these choices, but in making these choices, it wasn't like, I give up on all this saving nonsense and I'm just going to do it, whatever. Like, I got a bond at half of what I could afford. I bought a modest one-bedroom apartment. It's not like I was like, okay, cool, now I'm going to live like a rap star because I've decided to do this. And it, like, I think to answer Fred's question, like, if you've had a scare and you're like, oh my goodness, I have to suck the marrow from life because I nearly died or I became very aware of my mortality, it's very easy to think that you can throw money at the problem and live larger.
And I think that's exactly what I was going to say. Sucking the marrow from the life does not necessarily cost money. And the flip is, I mean, for example, my wife and I are going on an overly expensive West Coast holiday over New Year. And it's overly expensive by our standards, but not necessarily, but yeah, and we're using Voyager miles and companion tickets and et cetera, haggling and all the like. But it's a case of like, okay, this is, you know, we could do this holiday for a third of the price, but this is a dream holiday I've had and I'm happy and I've, you know, hit all the other points I needed to over the course of the year in terms of my spending habits, in terms of my saving and investing habits and the like. And part of my life includes having holidays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think for Fred, like as you were saying, you know, if you've got this daughter and you are suddenly very aware that you have limited time with this daughter, why don't you sacrifice financially by not working so much?
And spend time
and with her. Spend time with your daughter at home playing board games as opposed to being like, oh, well, I only live once, you know, let me buy my daughter something because to make her happy.
What happens if you only
live... Not that I say you do that, Fred. This is just an example.
What happens if you only live once to 130?
Yeah.
What happens then? Now, 130 is unlikely. What happens if you live to 96? That's likely. That is a real number on the table. Now your daughter is funding you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm preparing a lecture that I'm doing at Open Window at the end of this week. And I was thinking, so a lot of these, I mean, it's third year students and stuff, and they haven't really started working yet. And I thought a little bit about that situation and I was like, they've spent their entire lives now learning. They went to school and then high school and then they went to varsity and now they're going to enter the workforce. And the whole aim of entering the workforce is to accumulate stuff so that you can exit the workforce. Like financial independence, it's such a bizarre system. And I think we can be a little bit more careful about what we choose. So yesterday you and I were talking about whether or not we would ever work in Centurion if we got an opportunity to do so. And I was just like, the amount of money that you would have to pay me to give up the lifestyle that I have right now would have to be astronomical. Mm. Like I don't really think, like, I can't even imagine a number that would be big enough because my lifestyle matters more to me than my spending.
And this chap whose podcast and where he was talking about financial independence, who plays board games with his young girls, his point was is that so he trained as a pharmacist, took him 8 years, got $180,000 of debt, worked as a pharmacist, paid that debt off massively aggressively to get rid of it and all. And then, you know, it got to the point where he wanted to do something. He needed some unpaid leave. The company said no. And he's like, well, actually, this is really important to me. So, yes, and I'm doing it. And off he went and was able to, because he didn't have debt, because he had aggressively paid off his debt, because he drove he's currently driving an 18-year-old car and those sort of things. Whereas a lot of people in their early to mid-30s are drowning in debt because, student loans, overly large houses with rooms you never use, overly flashy motor cars that, do and prove nothing, etc. And he hadn't done it intentionally. He had just sort of done his life in a way that he realized that when his boss said you can't take unpaid leave, he's like, actually, I don't need this job. And ironically, he became a pharmacist because it's one of the top 10 paying jobs in America. And of course, he said the point they don't tell you is you work 70-hour weeks.
Yeah,
and he's like, I got kids, I got a wife, I don't want to work a 70-hour week, and so I will earn less, but I'll have a better life, and you manage it, you make those choices.
I think often we underestimate how many options we have. Like, I think we tend to think in terms of, I need to earn a salary, I need to get through the day, because that's kind of what we see when we grow up, and we don't realize, so my best friend has a six-month-old baby. And she works and the baby stays with her mother-in-law, but it's incredibly difficult for her to be without her baby during the day because he's 6 months old and he's super cute and like her body is full of hormones and all she wants to do is be with him. And I was like, if she had known that she could, would she have planned to be able to take a year off work to spend that year with her baby? Which is like biologically what your body wants to do. It wants to be with your baby for the first year, right? And that is an option that you have. And I think that we get so caught up in the, I need to finish school and then, and we've spoken about this before, like the idea of living a considered life. I need to finish school and then I need to find a job and then I need to meet somebody and then I need to get married and then we need to buy a house and we need to have children. Like
and that, two cars and extra bedrooms.
That trajectory is not compulsory. You have a choice there.
Yeah, and you're welcome to do it. And some people earn vast money and can and et cetera. And some people come and, inherit money or rob banks or something like that. But it's considered. Make the decisions rather than just fall into them. And be careful. And it's back to Fred's point is, yes, we are going to typically tip one way or the other too far. And finding that center line is
probably the work of your lifetime.
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, it's not hard, but it's, sometimes it's tricky to identify. It's tricky to make it happen. It's a process, and it is. You're probably doing it forever.
I think that's maybe what bothers me the most about this Guardian article. Is it seems like this woman is not making a choice.
Yes. Well, she thinks she is. She made the choice that I will eat out and that's my choice and I will have a overpriced. She's claiming she is making choices, but she isn't making the choices with a spreadsheet. She's making them on emotional
points. But she's not choosing what is important to her. So she's like, I want to have a dog and I want to have a designer life and I want to eat out all the time. And you know what? She can have some of those things, but she can't have all of those things, not on her budget. She can't have all of those things. And if she were like a super dog person and this article really was about her dog, then she should have stayed in the cheap apartment and had the expensive dog. Because you can, but she's not choosing anything. She's living somebody else's life here.
She's trying to have it all.
Well, no, she's not. Because the thing is, I don't really think this is having it all. Like, I think...
Well, by her metric, it is. Fancy apartment, dinner every night, dog, fancy scarf.
I think if you don't sit down and you go, this is what's important to me, then you don't know what having it all looks like. Like, are you the kind of person who gives everything for their dog, or are you the kind of person who lives in a fabulous apartment? And I think if you can make a choice about that, you can be like, now I have it all. But this seems like the kind of person who would never be satisfied. Like, she would have more money, and more money would just lead to more of these non-choices. More of these defaults that would just, like, this is just a very unconsidered way of living.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. So Chris is 24 and he needs to choose between an RA and a tax-free savings account. He says, if I have 2,500 rand to invest, should I be maxing out my tax-free savings account or putting money into an RA? And is only, so he's saying, if he only does a tax-free savings account, is only contributing to an RA when I'm 30 a crazy idea? So generally more conservative over a 30-year period and generally more expensive than the Ashburton 1200 is the RA. So he says, it seems like money in an ETF is the answer. Is it a dangerous thought to only start putting money into an RA once I'm 30 if I'm still contributing to a discretionary investment?
So, I mean, short answer is probably a lot of people don't start much before 30, or they do with company pensions and then they leave. Question is he also got a company scheme? I'm assuming not.
No.
In which case, I mean, there's something to perhaps be said. I mean, so, you know, this is one of those, there's no perfectly right answer. I mean, the RA gives you your tax saving. So if you put your $2,500 in, depending on what your tax bracket is, you're putting in $30,000 a year into your retirement annuity. If you're at a 30% tax bracket, you get $9,000 back. If my math right, yes. And you could then flip that $9,000 into your tax-free account.
Yeah, so that's generally what I do, but I have more than $2,500. Like in Chris's case, I would actually just go for the tax-free savings, to be honest. Because if you only have $2,500 to save, probably you're not in a very high tax bracket yet. Go for the tax-free saving just because it's...
With one proviso is be disciplined about it. Don't one day cash out your tax-free savings account to buy a scarf for your dog.
Dog scarves. That's the new fad. Then he wants to know, he's worried about the tax implications of share incentive schemes. So can you maybe explain what a share incentive scheme is?
So you work for a company, usually listed, but not necessarily always. And as part of your pay package, or maybe your signing on bonus, or maybe your bonuses that you receive, you know, bonus, whatever, as part of your payment from the company, they say if certain metrics are met, in other words, the incentive part of it, you will receive shares in the company. The tax implication is quite simple. Those shares are given to you at a value. So if it's a listed company, it's given to you today. There's a value on the market. And if you get 100 shares and they're valued at 10 rand a share, you've been given 1,000 rand and you have a tax liability on it.
Do you pay that today in the day where you get the incentive?
Correct.
So you don't pay it once it vests?
So it depends. So hang on. No. So let's say that we're doing a scheme and it's like, okay, so in 5 years, you will get X shares. And in 5 years' time, you get X shares and they're worth 10,000. Rand. The tax liability is due in 5 years when you get the shares.
So this is exactly Chris's point. He's like, isn't that going to result in a cash flow issue for you?
Yes. So what then often happens is people will sell, say you're in the 40% tax bracket, you sell 40% of the shares to pay the tax on them.
Boy.
The bigger issue is it might push you up into a higher tax bracket, which has implications then. But so yes, you do have to pay tax, and oftentimes you will see it where directors of listed companies have received X number of shares and they went and sold some of them to pay the tax liability, and then they keep the rest.
Yeah. Okay, so Sheila shared an anecdote about bonuses gone wrong on the Fat Wallet community. So if you go onto Facebook and you search for the Fat Wallet group, you'll find us there. She says, this was after obviously the episode we did on bonuses. Mm-hmm. In the UK in the early 1960s, my dad expected his discretionary birthday annual bonus, but the company had a bad financial year and they cancelled. So guess who cancelled summer holidays that year? It's still a better memory, as I'd bragged at school that we were going to Spain. I've never banked on a bonus or commission in my life, though. Lesson learned.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when they come, there should be bonuses. When they come, but sometimes they don't.
All right, Frank considers himself reasonably financially literate, but he's stuck now. He says, I've been managing my money from a young age using what I've read and learned to guide me. I got RAs, preservation funds, provident funds, share portfolios, tax-free savings. I've paid off my house. I have an emergency fund. In other words, he's sorted. I've done all the spreadsheets, calculated the future value on the growth of my portfolio and what I believe I need to live on when I'm retired. But I'm worried that I'll be blindsided later in life. This is such an interesting thing because we don't often get to talk to people who are completely fine and who get to luxuriate in the idea that they may have missed something. He says, I have 25 years to retirement, which is a significant amount of time. So if you make a miscalculation now, it could have like a really big compounding effect. He says, and it now seems to be a good time to do a proper evaluation of my position.
Yeah, so I mean, the easiest way is head over to 10X and plug your data in. They'll ask you how much money do you have saved across all your investment accounts. They will ask you how much you are currently saving, how old you are, and they'll tell you whether you're good, bad, or ugly.
So he says, when if he wants to speak to a truly independent financial advisor, he says, when looking for a truly independent financial advisor that aren't aligned to product providers and will have my best interests at heart, I'm battling to find one, and I don't know where to look as the internet is failing me. I'm clear about...
Yes, because there aren't really any.
He says, I'm clear about what I need from them. I need them to review my plan and calculations to tell me if I'm on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I need reassurance,
mm-hmm.
This is exactly what you need a financial advisor for, right? Like, this is exactly the job of a financial advisor. I don't need somebody who is going to sell me a product. I need somebody who's going to tell me what the real tax implications are of what I'm doing. So I do want to say to you, Frank, maybe when it comes to tax implications, don't look for a financial advisor, look for a tax expert, because a tax expert is not going to try and hopefully sell you a tax product, like an independent tax expert, because it's like two different skill sets, right? A financial advisor often will know a lot. An independent financial advisor will often know a lot about tax, but tax people are like a very specific
breed
of people who are very, very good at fine combing things in a way that's different from a financial advisor. So any advice you can give me to find an advisor would be great. And it would be better if you give me a set of names of people in Joburg that I could approach. Or is there an alternative that I haven't considered that may help me answer my question?
So before we answer the question, and there are some names we can throw out, there always is a risk that something happens. And that risk might be, I don't know, you lose your job or your company, et cetera, et cetera. Which is why I always say, err on the side of too much. You know, your downside. You know, and I'm not saying go and save 90% of your money. That's an extreme. But, you know, the rule is save 15 or 20%. Well, okay, why not 25 or maybe, 28 or 30, just to err on that side in case there's, because truthfully, his biggest concern probably is something out there that he just doesn't anticipate. And how do you plan for something you don't know what it is or how it's going to happen? I mean, the answer is you can't.
But I think that's a very wise way of going about your portfolio, because you can't anticipate the market. The market is very unpredictable.
I think a 10x calculator will, so I went a while ago and plugged into 10x, said, this is what I've got, this is what I saved, this is what I want in retirement. 10x said, you are ahead of the curve, carry on. And that just gave me that it was like, cool, okay, this is like, according to their math, and there's a lot of, if, buts, and maybes in their calculations, but any calculation about the future is if, buts, and maybes. And if he wants to see someone, I don't know, Craig Gradage, Warren Ingram.
Yeah, those are the two people.
Those are the only two we know.
So, I mean, we say those people, but we mean their companies. Yeah. Gradage Mahura Investments.
And Galileo Capital.
So what I do want to say is that even independent financial advisors have preferred partners that they work with. So if you go to Craig Gradage and you say, hook me up in the medical aids, they're not going to come with a Genesis medical aid. They've got medical aids that they work with and stuff. It doesn't mean they're selling you product. It just means that, they are turning themselves into experts in certain types of products, because you just cannot know everything about every single financial product in the market.
And if they come to you and say, don't like this or don't like that or whatever, very much interrogate why. You know, if they say this is a terrible product you're in and you should be in that product, like ask 50 questions as to why is this a terrible product and why is that one a better one. And returns is seldom the answer.
And also don't be afraid of seeing both.
Yeah, that's actually a cunning plan.
Pay 2,000 Rand up front and see two different financial advisors. Don't tell them what the other one said and just see what comes out, because if there's a hole in your portfolio, they're going to find it.
Yeah.
But if they're going to try and sell you something, you're going to know. Matthew has such a good question about buy it for life shares. He says, in the last minute of episode 117, I'm so glad people listen to the last minute of the show, you say that you should hold and never sell.
Mm.
How do you actually realize or extract money from the portfolio if you never sell anything, Simon?
Well,
he says, if you never sell, your money is just a figure on paper. So when do you actually make money?
So remember, there's two ways you make money from a share. And one is dividends. So you start accruing dividends and your dividends start becoming chunky. And when we did the one with Patrick, and his comment was that his dividends now fund months of his living expenses every year when they flow through. Those dividends do start start to really, really stack up. And the short answer is at some point you will start to sell down. But remembering you've probably also, I mean, it depends how the whole, so let's take a scenario where you've got a retirement annuity, a tax-free, and then some other ETFs as well. Your retirement annuity gives you some money, but it also then buys you an annuity, living or guaranteed or life, whatever you want. And off you boogie, you're getting money from there. And your shares are then sitting there. Now you might need to supplement your money that came out from the retirement annuity. You might prefer to you might use the shares to sell occasionally for holidays and stuff. The point is that when I say you never sell, you're selling like in your 60s, 70s, 90s, 131s.
So what I would say is that here's my plan for retirement, in actual retirement age, is that I would have a combination of a living and a guaranteed annuity, so that the guaranteed annuity always will pay my medical aid. Mm-hmm. Because I think as an old person, that's going to be my biggest mm-hmm. expense. And then the living annuity, so that the money that's in there can still continue to grow. Because a guaranteed annuity is an insurance product that pays you out a certain amount every single month until you die. And a living annuity is an investment product that is still invested the way that your RA was, or you can choose how you want to invest that product. Right. So that's one part of it. And then you've got the rest of your portfolio that gives you dividends, and hopefully you get those dividends in your tax-free portfolio.
And you might want to shift your portfolio into higher dividend, for example, perhaps cash, near cash, or property or stuff like that.
And I mean, we can all just hope and hope and hope that by the time I retire,
the market has moved.
Not only that the market has moved, but that financial products are a bit better, and that financial product providers are a bit better at giving you control over that. So that's one part of it, is that's also why. And I know that Stealthy Wealth, for example, is not a big fan of the RA game, but that's also why I like RAs, because then you can go, I mean, I suppose you can just take your own money mm-hmm. into a living and a life annuity as well. But, you know, then you have that kind of security sitting there just to take care of your basic expenses in old age. And then when you start selling down, you're gonna want to do that proportionally, I suppose. So if you have your yes. buy it for life shares, you're not going to sell all of your Sasols and then keep all of the others. You're going to sell some Sasols.
So I'd sell across the board, and I would probably pick and choose, and I would sell the ones I think were excessively expensive, and I would sell those, and I would generate cash from it. And whether I sell it all down in time, I'm not sure. But it's certainly one of the things I would probably look to do, and this would be more in my tax-free account, is move that very heavily to income-producing, in other words, dividend-paying assets, because of the tax-free nature, and then gently sell down some shares. And not a case of, I'm going for dinner on Friday, so let's sell shares on Thursday. A case of, well, I think this share price is exceedingly high right now. Let's sell a little bit, take that money, put it aside. It can go towards a holiday next year, or whatever the case may be. In other words, managing that process. You never want to be a forced seller. You always want a lot of cash/income, so that if markets collapse in a heap, you're not forced to sell at lows.
But I also think that you should manage this in terms of how your portfolio performed the previous year, because we often talk about the 4% rule, which is like kind of a rule of thumb. If you drew down 4% and inflation was 6% mm-hmm. and the market moved 10%, you'd be fine, right? And that's the idea. Your money would continue to grow. But I think what you would do is, if you have that combination of your living annuity and your life annuity to cover your everyday expenses, then you can look at what the market did, or what your portfolio, not the market, what your portfolio did the previous year, and then draw down accordingly. So you can see, okay, last year inflation was 5%, the market returned 13%, so I know that I've got 8% to play with. And do I want to draw down the full 8% in case next year is a bum year, or do I want to just draw down the 4% and have my portfolio grow a little bit above inflation?
Or take the 8, live on 4, and put 4 into a government retail bond to generate an income stream over the next X years, or
a cash situation or whatever. So Matthew, to answer your question, you would manage that process by slowly over time selling some of your shares, but never all at once selling all of your shares. Also, remember, when you do this, there's going to be a tax implication.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a capital gain tax when you sell down your like shares that you bought at 13 Rand and then sold at 5,000.
And it gets quite chunky. Yeah, no, because you've held them for a long, long time. But, I mean, further to Matthew's point is that this is a critical point, and it's, and I forget who wrote in and said, I've got my retirement annuity cashing out. Now what? Biggest amount of money I've ever seen. There's no one in the space talking about it. I mean, we touch on it occasionally when prodded, but there probably aren't that many people in retirement with you know, like these sort of complex sort of issues. Most people probably go into retirement, get an annuity, and hope for the best. But there certainly is a space lacking, because Matthew's next question is going to be, well, how do I know which share to sell and how much of it should I? And that's a, those are not unfair questions.
Mm. It's a very interesting thing to think about, and there's a lot to think about. I would love to see if I had the, when I become finance minister, because apparently everybody gets a chance. When I become finance minister, I would like to see that an allowance for retirees to take that one third that you're allowed to take in cash. If you don't take it in cash, to put it into a tax-free type product, because that would be amazing, right? That would allow you to take a third of your money and then go work it tax-free to help you out in retirement, but I didn't think that's
on the cards.
You're
saving tax twice, and that's not how Treasury works.
Well, how do you know? It's not your week, Simon.
Truthfully, I don't think anyone knows right now.
So we haven't heard from Sabata in a while, but now he's back with an excellent answer to a question we received quite a while ago. In episode 118, Greg asked about moving his RA, and he said there was a waiting period. Do you remember the 25 days? And he was like, what is going on? Sabata says the explanation for Sanlam's waiting period doesn't make sense. However, the waiting period may be valid if the investment was by debit order. With most banks, an investor can unilaterally reverse a debit order within 30 days. Thereafter, you need the cooperation of the receiving entity. When you decide to move your RA, don't forget to cancel the debit order instruction. You might think it's a given, but it's not. Sanlam will transfer your RA and continue with your debit order investment as if nothing has changed.
And go for lunch. Yeah, so it is that debit order process. But they then, I mean, it was the wording of the process, which should have been, you can, but you can only get the money. I remember when I moved my Satrix out of the AOS platform, and I had to do it in two parts. So the bulk part, and then the last debit went through, and they bought, and then they wait, and then some days later, probably 30, they finally move those last little remnants across.
So a friend of mine texted me yesterday to say that, because he's moving from AOS to Satrix Now, and they sent him a mail saying that you can't move your tax-free to the Satrix Now platform, which seems redonkulous.
So unless Satrix Now does not have a tax-free platform, and that seems totally ridiculous, they are lying.
Yeah,
tell them that when he is finance minister for his week, he's going to come knocking on their door.
So what I said to him is, if they don't allow it, just move it to the Easy Equity tax-free account and buy the Satrix product in there.
Yeah, I'm having a quick peek. Maybe the Satrix Now doesn't have a tax-free. Doesn't seem to mention it. That doesn't mean they don't. So the only reason is you can't move it to a company that doesn't have an offering of a tax-free account.
Yeah, but the Satrix Now platform is on the Easy Equities account.
Exactly. So therefore,
yeah, it seems stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So Anonymous has been appointed the executor of their grandparents' estate, which is in a trust, and they really want to do a good job of it. This was also after episode 118. That was a good one, apparently. He says, after episode 118 on inheritance, I was reminded that my uncle and I are the executors of my grandparents' estate, which is in a trust. It's not a lot of money, and there's a few good people between the aunts and the uncles and the cousins, so nobody's expecting 3 million rand. That said, I'd still like to do it right, and I don't know where to begin.
Get an expert.
Who?
So there are people, I mean, a lawyer, there are people who specialize in estates, there are people who specialize in trusts. You can negotiate the fee with them to get a lower fee. But it is particularly, you know, if it's just, you know, my little and no trusts and everything like that, there's still, you know, masters of the High Court and documents being lodged. And I remember with both of my parents' estates, although both very simple estates, and I was executor of both, I mean, I'd started to peer down that corridor, and I'm like, no. Going to get an expert. You know, just Google around and then negotiate a fee. I mean, you absolutely. So, like,
but isn't that the point of getting a family member to be the executor? So you don't.
No. So the point of a family member being an executor is that they can find someone who that they trust and who they think is charging a good fee. Because, like, for example, your bank will do you a free will, but then the bank becomes the executor, and they can then charge carte blanche whatever they want, and take as long, you know, and then you just end up another cog in a giant thing. Yes, I you know, to me this is just drawing up an estate is a complex process. There's a lot of legalese around it, a lot that needs to be done, a lot of documents that need to be submitted to the right places by the right times. You got to, you know, waiting periods for people to, I suppose, undie or I don't know, but there's all of it's complexity. And I always say to folks is, like, you know, put someone you know as a trustee, not because they will necessarily be it, but because they can go and vet someone and negotiate a rate.
So
go, and particularly if a trust is involved,
go check out Capital Legacy, because I know they specialize in that. And then also, if you guys don't have a will yet, there's this company called Zacfin. It's Zaqfin, where you can get a free will, and they basically just help you just set up a very basic will that you put together yourself. You print it out, you get two witnesses to sign it, and it's legally binding and whatever. So if you haven't gotten around to a will yet and you just want to have something in place while you figure your life out, go and do that. You don't want to be caught dead without one.
And don't forget the signatures. Yeah. Two witnesses. And frankly, phone Craig Gadage or Warren Ingram and say to them, who's your go-to guy for estates?
Yeah. So Shane says he's busy reading Sam's book, Manage Money Like a Grown-Up. It's an awesome book. You guys should all read it. He says, it's amazing, but I wanted to run something by you and find out what would happen. If South Africa's economy did tank like Venezuela, and I had a large portion of my savings in my tax-free savings account, and it was in the Global 1200, which is a US dollar-denominated ETF, because it's a local index, would that be affected by an economic collapse? Or because it's invested in global stocks, would it be protected? And what would it do if it were protected? Like, would it go up by a bunch? It would go up by a ton.
It's not a local index. It's a global index. In fact, it includes no Africa whatsoever. So the stocks within it would carry on plodding along, doing whatever they're doing, broadly tracking global growth plus a bit. And the ZAR component, assuming the ZAR went from 14 to 140, the value of...
You would be rich.
That would go up tenfold.
You would be rich. I think the only issue would be if our economy collapsed, probably you would struggle to sell.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the market maker should be there and buying back. But the question is,
unless the market maker doesn't exist.
Yeah, anymore. I mean, does Ashburton still exist? And the biggest problem in Venezuela and you know, the Weimar Republic in the 30s and the like was not the collapse, it was the rampant inflation. So you sell it today, you only receive the money in 3 days' time because of T plus three delivery process. By the time the money arrives in your bank account, there's been, you know, the inflation has just destroyed its value.
Yeah. Jose wants to know if there are marijuana shares that we can invest in from South Africa. That was so funny because a bunch of people asked about marijuana shares when it became legal to smoke weed at home. But it was always possible to buy marijuana shares in Canada. It has nothing to do with our legislation, really.
There are no locally listed shares. In the US, the marijuana shares are mostly around drug enforcement because marijuana in the US is still illegal at federal level. It's legalized at state level, but that means they can't have bank accounts. They can't register. You know, so like the marijuana index in the US of US stocks is companies that test for marijuana and that sort of thing and sell products into the industry. Canada is different. There's a load there. You can buy them. The best advice is don't.
Why?
Well, because they're the hot new space now, whereas this time last year it was Bitcoin and this time 20 years ago it was Pets.com or WorldCom or Enron. And the one that went, and I forget its name, Troy Lee, and our dear friend Petri actually bought the wrong company. So he bought what he thought was this Canadian drug company on the New York Stock Exchange, realized he'd bought the wrong company and made 50% because everyone made the same fucking stupid mistake. The company, I think it's TRLY is the code or something like that. I think it went up 300 or 500 or 600% in like 4 days. Basically, it's a company that has revenue of $20 million Canadian, profit of zero, and was valued at $20 billion. It's a bubble. And understand the distinction. Calling something a bubble, and this is because I got into this fight so many times this time last year around Bitcoin. Calling something a bubble is not a comment on the underlying business. It's a comment on the valuation of the business.
So it's Bitcoin, a comment on the price of the,
Bitcoin at $20,000 was a bubble. And I said it all the way from $10,000. And marijuana stocks in Canada right now are a bubble. And buying at the top of bubbles never makes money. Take that back. It does. If you bought the NASDAQ at the top of its bubble, 15 years later, it got back to that price. But if you'd bought the individual stocks, Amazon's there, but not many of the others are.
But look, if you bought something at a bubble and you held it for 15 years after that, you are a very strong
That's a good point, because you bought it to be rich by Friday.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
15 years of Fridays later,
Yeah. So Leafy has reached retirement age and now she wants to take some money offshore. She says, I'm over 55. I receive capital and interest monthly from the sale of my business and I should receive it for the next 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm paying tax on the interest. I'm still saving in case I live to over 90. I want to do a lump sum payment into an RA for tax efficiency. I want it to be invested 100% offshore, so it will have to be a living annuity and I will draw down 2%. So not an RA, a living annuity.
Yeah, that's so an RA is Reg 28. Annuity is not Reg 28 compliant. Someone asked me that the other day and I forgot to check.
No, I don't know.
Yeah. So if annuities are not Regulation 28 compliant, sure, you can absolutely just request an annuity that's 100% offshore. You might have to shop around for it. If they are Reg 28 compliant, they can't have more than 30% beyond the borders of South Africa.
But now she's saying, I can't contribute directly into a living annuity. It has to go through a normal RA and then transfer.
You can't just buy an annuity. I thought you could just rock up and buy one. Does it have to be from RA money?
I don't know.
So, I mean, if that's the case, then perhaps you want to go and... Okay, so then you've got to buy an RA and a month later cash it and...
No, but surely there must be an easier way to do this. Yeah, can't you just take the money?
Speak to 10X. So the easy... I mean, the other point is why not just go buy an annuity out of the UK? Or the US. The problem with that is twofold. Is that your returns are going to be very modest in the US. You know, again, the inflation differential, etc. And secondly, what happens if our RAND goes from the current 14 and change to, let's say, 7?
Yeah. Look, this sounds like a job for Candace Payne. I don't really know enough about annuities and stuff to know how you would be able to do this.
Yeah, or even because 10X do annuities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know Candace specializes in the offshore
and
stuff.
And so she specializes in the offshore part. Yeah.
Okay. Then our last email this week is a little bit sad. So Robin is in a tight spot with her family. She says, I listened to your 108th episode, and when the supporting the family topic came up, I had tears streaming down my face. I come from a single parent family, and I'm 31. My two siblings are 12 and 14 years older than I am. My mom recently had strokes and can no longer work, and my brother has simply turned his back on any responsibility. My sister earns a pittance and she lives with my mom and she relied very heavily on my mom to feed, clothe and house her. My mom also made the fatal mistake of cashing in her entire Provident Fund over a decade ago and spent it on clothes, gifts, furniture, so she now survives on her tiny SASSA pension. All the responsibility falls into my lap. I don't have that many dreams, but because of my poverty-stricken childhood, my main focuses are to have children and to raise them in a financially sound household, to build security and comfort for myself and my family. In other words, not to feed the cycle of poverty. I'm now paying for a hospital plan for my mom, which is 1,607 Rand each month. And I need to keep cash on hand because they're in a position where disaster is a regular thing. You know, this is so terrible because when you have very little money, any small setback can really just knock you on your
not the frequency of the disaster, and I'm not in any way dismissing Robin's disasters. It's the fact that such a small thing is a disaster.
And that's why we spoke in a previous episode about if you're a low-income earner, why insurance is so incredibly important. So, Robin, for your family, make sure that you've got, even though it's a pain in the ass and it's going to cost you some money. Make sure that you've got short-term insurance on the things that are going to cripple them. Yeah. She says, I agreed to put away 1,000 rand per month into a Capitec savings account if they need it. And if they need it, they have to justify why before I simply hand over the cash. They've always been poor and are the opposite of me. I tend to never spend anything on myself, whereas they go crazy on luxuries and then they can't pay the rent. My husband and I already pay 600 rand a month into our access bond, which is also serving as our emergency fund, which is far from our goal. I plan to downgrade my medical aid to a hospital plan and pocket the savings of 500 rand and add that to the access bond. And now I'm wondering if my family's 1,000 rand per month should also go in there. I figure that if I'm going to be sacrificing this cash in the future, I may as well make it work in my favor while I can. Is there such a thing as oversaving in an access bond? Are there any real risks to this? Also, can I include saving for my family as part of my spending and saving ratio, or am I fooling myself by doing this? What a great email.
Yeah, and frankly, I think Robin's largely on top of a very, very tough scenario. Couple of points. Access bonds, not any real downside, but do be careful of T's and C's. I know someone who had an access bond and tried to access it one day, and the T's and C's had changed, and they couldn't.
So this is the real risk, as far as I understand it. If you one day by accident can't or don't pay your monthly installment on your bond, your bank has the right to revoke access to your bond. Also, Stealthy recently saved a whole bunch of money because his bank revised his interest rates on his access bond. But one of the conditions was that he give up the money he had access to. So the risk in your access bond, Robin, what I would say is if your emergency fund is in your access bond, make sure you have a credit card or something that can cover your costs in case of emergency, just in case you can't access that access bond. You don't want to be in a position where you can't have access to that money. And sometimes it can happen just by accident. Like maybe there's a problem with the bank and your debit order doesn't go off and then suddenly they cancel your access.
Yeah.
But the 1,000 rand per month extra into that access bond is going to save you a chunk of money.
Yeah, but I like the idea of and I don't know if we're talking the same 1,000. The 1,000 in Capitec, I like that because it ring fences, it's separate, it's for her older sibling and mother. And if it's access bond, it starts to get messy, whose money is where and that sort of thing. And I appreciate that they want to spend it on dog scarves, her mother and older sibling. But it's just, you know, and Capitec gives you a decent rate of interest. I mean, you're getting some return on that there.
I don't know. I don't agree with you. I think that she should pop that money into her access bond and like have at least get the benefit of saving the interest on that 1,000 rand every month. Like, and I haven't.
No, sure. And the interest that she will save is undoubtedly more than the interest that she will earn. The interest that she earns has a tax liability, but not at 1,000 rand a month. You're not in that ballpark whatsoever. So, on a pure numbers game, she's better off in the access bond. I'm worried about the access bond being shut down. Yeah. I'm worried about blurring of lines as to whose money is where. But and there's a lot of blurring already.
I don't think there is a blurring of lines because it's Robin's money. Like, That money should be in her name at all times. And yes, she should be able to access it when and if she wants to help her mother and her sibling. Robin, maybe you should say to your mother and your sibling that you don't have that money to put away every month. And if they have an emergency and you feel like helping them out, then you can use that money, like store that money in your access bond and use it if you want to, but don't use it if you don't want to. Because the problem with people who don't understand money is if you say to them there's 1,000 rand per month and I'm putting it there for you for emergencies, they're going to start thinking about their money as their money, and it's not. It's
no, that's
your
a good point. So then in which case, go to the bank, get a copy of the contract and scrutinize the T's and C's around the access part.
Yeah.
And then while you're at the bank, ask them for a better rate. While you're downgrading your medical aid, ask them for a better rate.
Yes.
I mean, just hack around. Just hack around. I mean, the point is that whilst it's a horrid situation, at least Robin is managing the problem as opposed to the alternative, which is head in the sand and hope it goes away, because it never does.
Yeah.
So it's not lacquer. And just, you know, just it, in this scenario, the pennies matter. They always matter, but sometimes more than others.
Yeah. This is such an unfair situation. I'm sorry you have to be in it, Robin. It sucks. All right, that's it for the Fat Wallet Show this week. Please remember that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelife.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden Whitaker for managing that page for us. My name is Christopher Nealon. Thank you so much to Simon Brown. We will catch you again next time.